Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. Later, we are going to hear about how Fear Free, this amazing initiative, has truly made a difference.
Dr. Julia Albright is a veterinary behaviorist, and you know what? An associate professor at the University of Tennessee in...
Knoxville, Tennessee.
Yeah. Have you ever bumped into Dolly Parton?
I've actually bumped into Dolly Parton and her husband growing up. So,
really?
Yeah, I grew up in the same town in Brentwood, Tennessee, Franklin, Tennessee, where they live. So not in East Tennessee where she's from and where Dollywood is.
She's a huge animal lover, isn't she?
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's a generous soul altogether. We love Dolly.
Yeah, and I think America does too. I more and more, actually. Mm-hmm. The more we learn, I think that's the case. Not to mention appreciating her wide range of talent, mm-hmm. and how she gets younger every year. And she would answer that, I think, by saying, I have good surgeons, but I don't really know that answer. So I am here to talk to you about a connection that people have, before we get to dogs and cats. Here's how I'll bring it up. Let's say you are going for your driver's license exam, and you actually have to drive, and you haven't done that in a driver's exam since you were in high school. But in Illinois and other states, every now and again, they'll ask you to take that test. Or maybe there's a test you need to take for work to get certified to your next level, and without that, you don't get a big raise. And you're a bit nervous about these things. You feel it in your gut. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's happened to all of us. Is that right? And tell me about the fact that the gut and the brain are connected in ways that, I don't know, 10 years ago, we didn't understand.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're talking about the sort of logical, we all have firsthand experience with the brain-gut axis, that our stress, you know, we get the butterflies. Again, we're talking about, you know, going to our... talking about our pets, we have stress colitis. Clearly, after boarding, you know, they might have loose stool for a couple of
days. So the same
days.
Thing is true with dogs and cats, is what you're saying.
Yes, absolutely. That clearly, we got a stressor, and we've got, you know, diarrhea is the most easy for our clients and for us to recognize. But the opposite direction as well is what's going on lately in the scientific community and just exploding with research, particularly neuropsychiatric diseases like Alzheimer's, like autism, like Parkinson's, have been linked to gut health as well.
And if it's true for aging in people, it's likely true for sure for dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And I would assume many cases for cats as well. Is that the case?
Correct. So aging can impact our gut, but really what you're impacting is the living organisms within the gut.
So it turns out, from what I understand, there might be a connection in some way between gut health and Alzheimer's in people, as you suggested. Dogs and cats may not get Alzheimer's, but they do get something called canine or feline cognitive dysfunction syndrome, which is really very much like Alzheimer's. So are we going to, at some point, you think, better understand how to maybe not prevent that, but delay the onset of it? Or who knows, maybe even prevent it, or at least some way impact or treat it involving gut health?
Yes, absolutely. There are several mechanisms that some folks, even if there's a veterinarian in Germany named Holger Voke, who's done some really fascinating, he's starting to do some fascinating stuff with the gut and how that affects, say, seizures. But I think a lot can be taken from that research to aging as well. So one example is, how does stress create or facilitate the onset of dementia, any type? So one thought is, and this could go for diet as well. So poor diet, psychological stressors, such as, I think I've seen a lot in the news lately about how social isolation is sort of a epidemic in this country. And so one of those mechanisms may be psychological stress or the lack of, you know, environmental enrichment. So how would all of those affect the gut? In different ways and different mechanisms, they can either promote. So stress creates the stress response. So that's our sympathetic nervous system as well as our HPA system. And so those could create things like adrenaline or cortisol. So when we have chronic stress, those can affect the gut environment. So, for example, when we have one type of pH that may be in a stressful condition, that might promote harmful bacteria growth and actually inhibit the growth of beneficial bacteria. And what's beneficial about them? Their metabolites can create, say, anti-inflammatory factors. So diet, stress, lack of stress, so good diet, good mental stimulation, what those could do is promote an environment where the beneficial bacteria can grow, and then those anti-inflammatory factors could potentially decrease everything from Alzheimer's disease, seizures, things like that.
In fact, there is a diet that is really an anti-seizure diet. You're going to help me with this.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something in that diet that later the veterinarians found actually benefits brain health.
Yes. So that diet, those diets, one example of it that has been approved for both the treatment for the therapy for canine cognitive dysfunction, as well as that same diet for seizure as an adjunctive treatment for seizure therapy, that is called Purina NeuroCare. And what it contains, the active ingredient, is called MCT, or medium-chain triglycerides. So that provides, that's a mildly ketogenic diet. And don't let that term scare you. You know, I think a lot of us that are veterinarians, we hear like, you know, ketones and cats, you know. but ketones can be a great alternative fuel source. So glucose is what, you know, we've evolved to use as fuel, but these ketones created by the MCT diet, our brains just work beautiful. Neurons love ketones. So it's just helping our neurons function better.
And to my knowledge, I mean, thank you for remembering the exact name of the diet. I appreciate that because I didn't. But from what I understand, this has been used, everything you just said, in humans as well. To stimulate brain function. Is that the case?
Yes. I mean, yeah. A lot of our, it turns out humans are good medical models for our cats and dogs, aren't they?
Particularly for
yes,
dogs.
Yes, we can learn a lot from them. So, of course, we extrapolate quite a bit from the human literature because that's where most of the research is. But yes, absolutely, that we know that from humans, and that can particularly be taken to the canine world. Can feel, so humans and dogs are both omnivores. We can get them, it's easier to get dogs to eat plant material. We're still working on that for cats, is my understanding, that cats, to get them to eat that plant-based diet,
and
it's not very palatable to them,
right.
So we're working on it.
You're saying that kind of tongue-in-cheek, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, because cats are carnivores. But there are some people, actually, I want to make it clear that you're not serious about that, because there are people that seriously want to feed their – I'm a vegetarian, so I will feed my cat the same way. Your dog, you may be able to get away with a cat, not a good idea.
I believe that there is some research out there on vegan diets, so plant-based, very little. You know, can we provide that for people who have those pet parents who have an ethical issue with feeding meat? And I will definitely have to consult with my nutrition colleagues.
I don't think we're there yet, though.
Right. That's my understanding is it's not the best for the cat. So,
right,
you know,
right.
But definitely if you have a client that wants to go that route, or you yourself definitely want to, please, please, please contact a veterinary nutritionist to talk. Lots of them will formulate diets for you.
Indeed.
So talk with one of them about how to even attempt to promote that. But
when we come back, I want to talk about a supplement that you can add easily to your dog or cat's food. If your dog or cat is anxious, that's in part what we're leading up to. And I also want to ask you about some misconceptions people have about dogs. Let's talk about how dogs are wolves or they're not. And we will do that when we come back on WGN. Back with you on WGN Radio with veterinary behaviorist Dr. Julia Albright. What is a veterinary behaviorist?
We are our educational trajectories are not dissimilar from a psychiatrist, but so we have been to veterinary school. Most of us have done an internship or been out in GP general practice for some time. And then we went back and did a very concentrated, focused, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 years or so, only focused on, or largely focused on, behavioral medicine, where we are integrating learning theory and physical health and neurobiology into the treatment. So looking very much holistically. I always joke I am your other general practitioner, because unlike other specialists, at least in my hospital, which is point of care, I'm chronically their vet. Like, I've had patients for a good chunk of our caseload I've had for over 5 or 6 years.
And what dog or cat doesn't have a behavior problem? Now, I say that very carefully, because that behavior may be perfectly normal for that dog or cat to do, but maybe barking at the door if you live in an apartment is not something that is practical or can be tolerated by the neighbors. So it might be perfectly, quote, normal for the dog to do, but mm-hmm. it becomes a problem. Or it can be a serious behavioral issue because of anxiety. Separation anxiety is just one example. I would argue through their lifetime, most dogs, most cats suffer some sort of issue, or we suffer some sort of issue as a result of their natural behavior. And I think that you are the most important specialist in veterinary medicine, in my opinion. More animals die, it turns out, from behavior than cancer or kidney disease or heart disease or anything else.
Correct. Yeah, I don't know the stats off the top of my head, but I definitely know of some studies looking at shelters, for example, and people who admitted why they are relinquishing the animal to that shelter. That behavior, it may not be the number one reason, but it is very frequently in most of those cases, I would say at least over 50%.
And when it's not, people often don't divulge.
Correct.
That,
like, that's a false, probably quite an underestimation.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you have a bond with that pet, you're not going to give them up when you move.
And people don't want to give them up generally.
Yeah. I think we're in, you know, with the economy the way it was for the last couple of years, I think that's a different conversation.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You work a little bit harder to make it work out if you have a strong bond. And there's nothing that breaks a bond more quickly than chronic unwanted behaviors.
Yeah, exactly right. So I thank you and your colleagues for what you do. We were talking before the break about how gut health and brain health are indeed connected to one another. And I want to ask you about specifically something new or reasonably new that's out there called calming care. What is that?
Calming care is a probiotic. So probiotics in general are living organisms. This is a living bacteria called Bifidobacterium longum.
Easy for
strain
you to say.
BL999.
Ooh, okay.
We can call it B longum if you would like.
Or calming care.
Or calming
that's
care.
Much
exactly.
To say.
Yep, that's a specific Nestle Purina product that you can get for cats or dogs. It's intended to be used daily. It is not a point, it's not a stressful event type of thing. There are other supplements we can use for that, but this is intended to be used daily to reduce anxiety, you know, mild to moderate mm-hmm. anxiety, or how I often use these is in conjunction with my more powerful psychoactive medications, the prescription medications. I'm often layering those.
It's interesting now. So I was around before you, and there were no choices, or very few choices,
mm-hmm.
or it was a guess, can this human psychopharmacological drug help dogs? But people really, the studies weren't being done necessarily at that point in time. Today, there are all sorts of supplements that are out there. So there are products like if your dog is anxious about car rides, using what we just said, calming care every day, using something like Zilkine, for
mm-hmm.
example. And you can explain what that is. But great-grandma was right about that warm cup of milk calming things, and that's kind of what that
mm-hmm.
does. We don't even necessarily need to go to drugs, but I want you to also talk about how going to drugs is not a bad thing.
Right. So
in the right circumstance, of course.
Correct. Yeah. So most of the time, people are coming to me because they know I'm a veterinary behaviorist. I always talk about medications last. there are certain cases where I'm looking at them, I'm like, this animal, we're certainly going to be discussing medications as part of the plan. But what medications do, there are definitely some thunderstorm phobia. So these animals that are really digging, they are panicking. Sometimes these medications that create sedation along with anti-anxiety effects, they are a welfare concern, right? This is either the client's not sleeping, the pet parent's not sleeping, or their house is getting destroyed and therefore the bond is being broken. But, you know, the primary concern is the welfare of that animal at that moment. But then there's a whole nother world where we're looking at, helping our basic environmental modification and behavior modification plan work better. So the medications alone, I've heard some numbers. I think a lot of us kind of bandy around that, you know, probably 20% of our caseload, you only gave the medication, the client is going to, the pet parent family is going to say, yes, I think this is doing something, with very little of the other things we talk about. The vast majority of cases, though, it helps that plan work better, right? If you are stressed out and you're afraid, you can't learn very well. So
I want to stop you there, yeah, just because I think this is an important point to make. So if your dog has, I'll use separation anxiety, that's a panic attack.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, two things, and we only have 2 minutes to do this. So and we could do this in what, 2 hours?
Yes.
Maybe. So a dog that has separation anxiety, first of all, is it truly separation anxiety and the dog isn't having a pizza party and that's mm-hmm. why the dog is tearing up the pillows, you know, mm-hmm. having fun. So showing a video to your veterinarian of what it looks like rather than assuming it's separation anxiety, right. I think that's really important. Okay, but let's say it is separation anxiety, mm-hmm. right? Dogs cannot, if it's a panic attack, dogs or people for that matter, how do you learn if you're panicked? You cannot. So that's where the drugs come in, I believe, to adjust brain chemistry so it makes it possible for that dog to learn.
Right. Separation anxiety is sort of the confluence of all the problems. So we've got a long-term problem because people are leaving frequently, right? This dog repeatedly needs to be left alone. So that's why we're looking at the human antidepressants, which are good, safe, long-term anti-anxiety. But then on top of that, every time the people leave, we have a welfare problem. We have a panic attack. So we layer things that are in the human antidepressant class on top of that, these more powerful event medications. And it's going to be individual. So it could be everything from Zoetis' Celio off-label to Xanax to Atrazodone, which helps them sleep better.
Depending
or
on
all
the dog.
Of them.
And I'm even, yeah. I'm even hesitant to mention the drugs because I worry that people will go to their own medicine cabinet, which can be a dangerous thing for your dog.
Correct. Yeah. Different drug doses. Some of them are perfectly fine. Some of them are not.
All right. You and I could talk for like
we
hours.
We could. Yes.
This is great. Dr. Julia Albright, veterinary behaviorist, and I thank you so much for your time.
You are welcome. It's my pleasure.
It's been an educational opportunity for us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Social media posts promoted the Taz Hau Zoo in China unveiled a new exhibition featuring panda dogs. Visitors were charged 20 yen, that's about $3 to see in our money, to see this new attraction. Thousands who traveled to the zoo ultimately discovered that the animals were actually dyed chow chow dogs. A worker at the zoo reportedly denied the accusations of false advertising and said, "This is just a new display we offer to visitors." Indeed, that is true. It's a new exhibition, and they are sort of panda dogs like they promised, but really, not really. Animal rights groups were concerned about the dyed dogs, that the dye would be a problem, but the dye is probably harmless. This is not the first time a zoo in China has tried to pull off this kind of stunt. So next time you go to a Chinese zoo, be very careful.
He is a veterinary behaviorist. He is sometimes called my brother. He is Dr. Gary Landsberg. We are brothers, right?
From another mother. Yeah, sure.
That's happened a bunch.
We can talk about the times where we put on each other's sports jackets. I guess we're around the same size. The times where people confuse us. And the times where we even got our badges mixed up at a conference after doing an interview.
And nobody knew the difference.
Well, they said, "Are you Steve Dillon?" Yeah.
I will take no responsibility for being that guy, I'm sure is what you said.
But our wives know.
Sometimes. So, question for you. You have been involved from day one, as have I, in a different way, with an initiative called Fear Free. You've been about around veterinary medicine for a few decades, to say
you
the
got
least.
It.
Yeah. Have you seen anything impact the profession as Fear Free has?
Not off the top of my head. I think that it's one of the most important advances and growth overall in the field is identifying and addressing fear, anxiety, and stress in pets, learning how to prevent it, learning how to alleviate it, knowing that it's the, and learning how to recognize it. That's a big one.
That is a big one.
Owners, veterinarians, trainers, etc. And it's really, really important to be able to reduce it in all aspects of life. So as behaviorists, of course, we've been talking about the importance of preventing and alleviating fear, anxiety, and stress for the physical health, the mental health of the pet, so pets can learn, just overall welfare. That's the right thing to do. But now it's a little more specific to the veterinary clinic environment. Initially, and that's the big growth in the field, fear-free pets. But even then, it's now out into the pet owners with fear-free happy homes, into the shelters, into other species than dogs and cats like equine and avian. So fear-free is really advancing the field and hopefully educating.
There isn't a veterinary school, I don't think, that doesn't teach fear-free and, in fact, mandate as a part of your education to become a veterinarian that you learn about it, which I think speaks volumes for the importance of this and also the understanding that, yes, veterinarians, when first trained as a veterinarian, you may learn how to do surgery for that animal. You may learn the anatomy of that animal. You can learn, okay, when you listen to the heart, this is what you're listening for. That's all important, clearly. But the emotional well-being of the animal, to me, is equally as important.
Behavior education is somewhat lacking in veterinary schools. Surprisingly, even though not all veterinary schools have veterinary behaviorists and clinical departments of behavior, almost all of the veterinary schools will have a veterinary behaviorist who comes in and lectures and educates the students. I wouldn't say it's every veterinary school, but many of the veterinary schools mandate or require or at least recommend the taking of the fear-free program and the fear-free course. So there's an additional minimum of 8 hours of education on identifying and alleviating and preventing fear, anxiety, and stress that veterinary students can have. And thanks to fear-free, veterinary students, veterinary technician students, veterinary faculty, all register for this program for free.
So
that's free education for,
free is good.
For the veterinary schools and the veterinary students.
Anecdotally, I want to talk about two things. One is anecdote. The other is get into what you enjoy, and that's science. But first, anecdotally, it appears to me that if I come in to see my veterinarian, and at the end of the day, I'm just another pet parent, and come in with my, say, cat, and my cat is anxious, maybe even terrified. I would argue many cats, some dogs, and just about all of those small animal pets, guinea pigs and pet ferrets and all the rest, pet birds, probably literally think they're going to die. That's how afraid, terrified they are. Literally think they're going to die.
Well, they have no control. They can't predict what's going to happen. If they haven't been to the veterinary clinic, they don't know what's going to happen. If they have been to the veterinary clinic and had a bad experience, they do know what or think they know what's going to happen, if I can use the word think a little bit literally, figuratively. But having said that, it's important to realize that they don't always show it unless you know how to recognize fear, anxiety.
That's an interesting but important point, yes.
And that's what Fear Free is partly trying to do. Recognition for the pet owner with Fear Free Happy Homes, recognition for the veterinary professionals who do or don't get enough education in veterinary school, and with experience it certainly grows. But there's an inhibited form of fear.
Learned helplessness is what you're about to talk about?
Yeah, but not even at that level, because if you think of the four stages of fear, and we're also dealing with anxiety and stress, but I'll just deal with fear as an example, or four examples of fear. We talk about terms flight, fight, freeze, and fidget. So freeze might be like this learned helplessness that you're seeing, or just a stage. But fidget, or you know, whatever term you want to use, fiddle in that term, is often these stress-related behaviors like lip licking and paw raising and some of the body posturing.
And who recognizes those?
Yes. So
that's
they're not
the
learned helplessness. Yeah. They're what you might call inhibited or passive signs of fear. And those are the ones that have to be recognized. And sometimes people think that's milder, but even in the research that we do, sometimes when you take something as simple as a cortisol level, which can be a sign of stress.
That's a stress hormone.
Yeah. You'll find that an animal with these very inhibited, quiet, relaxed-looking fears have just as high a heart rate, just as high a cortisol level from their fear as a pet who was barking, aggressive, trying to run away, trying to hide, etc. Both forms of fear, whether they look terrible or look mild, have to be recognized as being fear. And if that's the case, let's prevent it before they come into the veterinary clinic. Let's treat it if they're there and have the problem. By there, you're usually talking injectable medications. Before means why don't they get it at home before they get there?
And what you're also talking about is science. To demonstrate that everything you say is true, we're going to talk about that science, including some new science you are about to hear first on WGN when we come back with Dr. Gary Landsberg. Dr. Gary Landsberg is a veterinary behaviorist based in
Richmond Hill, but Toronto, Canada. We'll give the GTA, the bigger city, the plug here.
Are you impressed with Connor Bedard?
Yes, I'm also impressed with the former first-round draft choice of, you know what I'm going to say, Austin Matthews.
Yeah, so is what age was Matthews, do you know, when he came to the Maple Leafs? Was he about 20?
Yeah, in that
That's
range,
old compared to Bedard.
He might have been a year younger, but, Toronto has three or four top stars, but this year he's just putting those pucks in the net.
Is it impossible to get hockey tickets in Toronto still?
It's always been impossible to get hockey tickets in Toronto. Yeah, Toronto fans, if you ever watch hockey, we're off topic here, but if you ever watch
this is an important topic.
As you travel through different arenas across North America, you will see Leaf fans everywhere. You know, you're watching a Blackhawk game and you hear, go Leafs, go. You're watching an Oilers game and you hear, go Leafs, go. There's just Leaf fans who go everywhere because it's easier to get tickets in these other places than it is in Toronto.
Ah, maybe that is why.
And they're loyal fans.
Yeah, yeah.
And we like to travel.
And you like hockey. You know what, though? I went to a hockey game here the first year of the Golden Knights, here meaning Las Vegas. We're at a veterinary conference in Las Vegas. And it was the first year. And the Golden Knights were playing the Maple Leafs. So you'd see, 15%, I'm making that up, of the people that were there were wearing Golden Knight jerseys. Only 15%, but it was their first year. 10% or so were wearing random other teams, visiting Las Vegas as tourists and wearing their team. The rest, Maple Leafs. You know, and that's Maple Leaf fans.
Love them or hate them.
Well, if you live in Toronto, I think you have to bleed blue. There's no other way around it.
Some Senators fans and some Oilers fans.
Really?
Maybe they just go against the grain.
Yeah, I know one of those Senator fans, actually, that we both know well. So I have a question to ask you about fear-free, which is what we're talking about, and that is the notion of minimizing fear, anxiety, and stress in veterinary visits, but also in daily life of your pets that you might not recognize. It was set up some number of, 4 years ago? 7 years ago, maybe. Somewhere
16,
in there.
17, 18, and around there. So
yeah.
6, 7, 8 years ago.
Yeah. And was based on science from day one. But now there is much, in great part thanks to you, much more science, as Fear-Free offers grants to independent researchers. So tell me about some of that recent science.
Yeah, it's important to note that, the Fear-Free, I'll mention briefly, mission is to prevent and alleviate fear, anxiety, and stress in pets by inspiring and educating the people who care for them. Starting out with the veterinary client, but now expanding into many more areas that's beyond what we can talk about today, even the intention of including farm animals and other species in here. But everything was developed by board-certified specialists, the continuing education program, and the knowledge and science that they had at the time, which was many, many articles, but research advances very quickly, and anecdote has to be backed by some level of science. That's not to say that if you treat a pet that's fearful, or deal with a pet that's fearful, and it's less fearful with what you do, literally less fearful, not just looking less fearful and you're not recognizing it properly, then obviously you did what was right for that animal. But to have protocols, to have strategies in place, to use medications, you need some science or data, not just some literally expert telling you that they work. There has to be some
basis for all of that,
scientific basis. Even the drugs and medications that are used for reducing fear, anxiety, and stress of travel and veterinary clinics, none of them are licensed for animals. So they haven't been looked at one or two have licensed, but not for that application. So they haven't been looked at because drug companies and the manufacturers haven't looked at them. So to make sure that everything is evidence-based, Fear Free has a grant program directed in three areas. One is grants to behavior specialists, veterinary behaviorists. One is grants to veterinary colleges so that students can learn and grow the research. And the third one is an online site open to any researcher. And over the years, we've probably funded maybe 30, 40 since the start of
Fear
Free.
Wow, I didn't even know.
And 10 or 11 of those published now.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So we can talk about some of those results.
Which we will do. I want to back up a little bit. When you said drugs being used, not licensed, I just want to make clear, it's okay. They are being used what's called off-label. And in fact, most drugs in the veterinary world, not only for psychopharmaceutical purposes, just drugs in the veterinary world for anything, are oftentimes human drugs that have been for years, decades and decades, used what they call off-label. It's very legal, and it's just what's done.
In fact, the 2, 3, 4 licensed drugs, well, 3 because one of them isn't a human drug, were used off-label and now have been looked at and researched and are labeled for veterinary use. But having said that, exactly, these are human drugs that have been shown to be effective initially anecdotally or just a few case studies, but then the true studies are what you would refer to as masked or placebo-controlled trials, where you have a placebo group, where you have a treatment group, and you see if the treatment group effect exceeds and improves the animal compared to a placebo group.
That's
what's being funded.
Right, and I just wanted to clarify that one point so people don't think veterinarians are doing anything bad. So I want to talk about some examples of some of the science that you have funded, that you recently have results for.
Yeah, and it's not all drug research. I can mention one that we did, that we funded, that the researcher looked at food preferences, because we know that one of the key elements of Fear Free is called putting the treat into treatment, making the veterinary visit extremely positive by using the favorite treats. Well, what are the pet's favorite treats? Can an owner determine that at home? And this one small study, which is published and the results can be looked up, by the way, you go to the Fear Free Research website, every published article you can click on and you'll see the results if they're final. In this study, the researcher looked at the preference of different treats in the home, found out that you could do a preference test that was valid, and those very treats would then be the ones that might be preferred in the veterinary clinic. There's the science, but each case is an individual.
Sure.
Some dogs, despite their favorite treat, might like novelty more. Some might have an association with it that they had a previous unpleasant experience in the veterinary clinic. So again, we need to base our work, our protocols, our procedures on science, on knowledge, but we also be treating the individual patient with that knowledge.
Yeah, we're running out of time, but what I love are the videos of, and these are fear-free practitioners, of course, or technicians, or both, where I don't know who began this. I think it was a veterinarian from your Happy to Know Canada, if I recall correctly, where treats were put on a wall. It could be peanut butter or whatever it is. Was he Canadian?
Jonathan Bloom? Is
talking about? Yeah. And the dog is so busy licking off from a licky mat or whatever is used, those treats, but the dog has no idea on the other end there's a vaccine happening. And the vaccine happens so fast, the dog has no idea.
But you missed the part that he does.
What?
He will sometimes write the pet's name.
Oh, right.
In the peanut butter or yes. the whipped cream or whatever yes. on yes. the pet scale or on the wall or on the mat, and the dog licks its name off or in its cage. And the other research, by the way, a bunch of them, because I can mention it in just a few seconds, is some drugs and medication, which have been used through some experience, but now they've been looked at for travel and veterinary visits. A study published with gabapentin, with trazodone, with something called the CHILL protocol, and they can be all looked up at the site, but clients should know that when we use medication for pets, it's for their welfare, it's to reduce the amount of anesthetic we might need, it's for actually anxiety contributes to pain, and all these medicines now have some background in studies to show that they are effective at preventing or alleviating fear, anxiety, and stress.
And I have a few seconds here, so I want to take that opportunity to say this, and that is thank you to you. You are and have been a leading veterinary behaviorist, a leading voice in veterinary behavior, a leading voice in veterinary medicine for many, many years. And aside from the work you've done and continue to do with Fear Free, you have contributed to this profession in a huge way and have been a guest on the show and tolerated me for a long time.
Well, I'm not just reciprocating because people think we're brothers, but truly, with your work with cats and with your work with the Fear Free Happy Homes, because I wanted to mention that, your voice has been extremely important to allow our voice to be heard.
Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Gary Landsberg, we will talk soon.
Thank you.
This is the time of year when I most want to remind people again, if you are not protecting your dog against heartworm and doing it consistently the way you should be doing it, according to the direction on the packaging and different products offer different timetables, then you are not doing your dog, in fact, you are doing your dog a disservice, because heartworm disease can actually kill dogs. And even when treated, by the way, the treatment way more expensive than prevention, and the treatment is so difficult for the dogs. I mean, it is like, you know, I'm not going to equate this exactly like cancer treatment. That is very, very difficult. So this is in some ways kind of the same thing. Not only that, even once the dog is quote-unquote cured of heartworm, there's been damage, permanent damage that's been done. We now know that by most recent studies. And by the way, cats get heartworm too. So protect your dog and even indoor cats. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.